Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with a key jazz cat on the modern scene on the vibraphone, Stefan Harris. Over the course of our conversation, we discussed many things, from making an album in Havana, Cuba, to a new app he is developing these days, his passion for teaching, what he loves about waking up each day, and why the vibes are so cool, along with much more. He's a very cool, evolved, and passionate musician that imparts wisdom in every answer and story he talks about. Dig it, my friends.
Hey, thank you for taking a little time to talk with me today. It's a big honor. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. It's no problem at all.
Right on. Let me go ahead and dive right in here. I know you're a busy man, but I kind of want to get an idea of what's been going on with you lately.
That's a good question. Well, you know, as an artist, I've always felt that it's very important to allow yourself space to grow.
Yeah.
So when I look at, if you look back at the series of records that I've done, the 10 or so records that I've done, there's generally a few years in between each record. And I feel as though a record is to document something unique, something that is special, and something that I feel I need to get out. So in order for that to really unfold and develop, I need to take space and challenge myself. So I've taken a little time off to work on some other things, and I'm just getting to the point now where the hunger is really there to get in the studio, so I plan on making a record in the next few months, actually.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So let me go back to where you were born and raised in Albany and ask you what it was like growing up in Albany that gave you this love of music and more specifically for jazz.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think my love for music goes beyond style. I certainly appreciate all types of music. And my early exposure to music was not in jazz. My mother's a Pentecostal minister, so I grew up in the black church, and I heard lots of really soulful, authentic gospel music.
Yeah.
And also just hearing a lot of great soul music around the house growing up. But then I was exposed to a fantastic organization called the Empire State Youth Orchestra, in which I met an absolutely brilliant private teacher by the name of Richard Al Bagley. And he opened up the world of Beethoven and Stravinsky and Scriabin to me as an eighth grader, and it completely changed my life. So my earliest passion in music was always for soul music, but then for classical music, long before I became interested in jazz. It really wasn't until I got to college that I developed a passion for jazz. I didn't know much about jazz. You know, I think the thing about music is it's sort of it's a manifestation of something deeper. It's a way to express something that's inside of you. So whatever it is that's inside of me, I was going to find a way to get it out one way or the other. But when I came across Charlie Parker when I was in college, it became apparently clear to me that jazz is one of the most articulate art forms ever created. And I immediately wanted to learn more about it and to dip my toe in the water, if you will.
Absolutely. So what instrument did you start out on?
I started out on the piano. I was self-taught, actually. My family moved into an apartment, and someone left an old beat-up piano behind. And in the bench of the piano, there were several books for children. And I took those books out and looked at the pictures and memorized what the notes were and ended up learning all my major triads and learned to read music. So that by the time I went to elementary school in, let's say, around third grade or so, I was playing piano for the citywide choir. And so I started that way. And then when you start to take lessons in elementary school, it was usually around fourth or fifth grade, because I could already read music, I was a little bit more advanced than some of the other kids. So to keep me busy, my teachers would just keep giving me different instruments.
Yeah.
So I ended up playing trumpet, not very well. I played clarinet fairly well, and I played flute, and I played trombone in the high school marching band. I basically would jump around from instrument to instrument. I probably played 20 instruments when I was a kid.
Wow. So how did you land on the vibes? Why is that the instrument of choice for you now?
You know, I don't know that it is. I think what happened was I when I was in eighth grade, I saw an orchestra on television one Christmas Eve. And I looked up the name of the orchestra in the phone book. And I called him and I said, "Hey, my name is Stefan and I want to be in your band." And so they said, "Hey, kid, what do you play?" And my two best instruments at that point were clarinet and percussion. So I auditioned on both. I got alternate on clarinet. I was accepted as a percussionist. And I think it was just a matter of which door opened for me. If it
Absolutely.
Weren't percussion, it'd be clarinet. And if it weren't clarinet, it'd be piano or something else.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to tell you up front, we have a very, very obvious bias here at Beyond Jazz. We love the vibes. So since that's our instrument that we really dig the most, I want to ask you, what is the coolest thing about the vibraphone?
I actually think it's the sensitivity of the instrument. It's one of the, when you compare it to a lot of brass instruments or woodwind instruments, our dynamic range is actually more subtle. There are times when I'm playing and I'm playing a note several times and I'm letting it get softer and softer and the audience is watching this unfold. And I can take it all the way down to the point where I'm just moving my hands and I'm not even hitting the note, but you can tell the audience still hears it because they see the motion. So I also love the visual element of the vibes, that people actually see the music being made as you're playing this particular instrument. It's very different than a tuba, for example. Nothing against the tuba, of course. The vibraphone is more visual. And then the tone of the vibraphone, if I could describe it emotionally, it's a very empathetic instrument. It sort of wraps itself around the general sound of all the other instruments and blends without a fuss at all.
Wow. That's a great way of putting it. That's a great, great visual. Let me ask you about this. This venture in 2011, where you recorded in Havana, Cuba with David Sanchez and Christian Scott. Talk to me about that project. That sounds like a fascinating kind of project you got involved with.
Well, that's a great example of how sometimes art is very, very unpredictable. We went to Cuba and we had no idea what we were going to do, really. We hadn't really met the musicians that we were going to be playing with. Basically, we started writing and collecting music literally just a week or two before. In fact, the process of getting to Cuba was so convoluted at that time, we really didn't know if we were going to go until just a few days before.
Wow.
So it was a great, great experience because you showed up, and the first day we sat around a table and had some food and just talked and listened to music together and just got to know one another. And it was like we understood that we were about to embark on a beautiful journey together and that everything was going to be okay if we trusted and respected each other. And we knew that we were going to be in the studio literally days later. And I think art is one of the very few formats that allows people to have that level of love and trust as they sit and face the unknown.
Absolutely. So along with this venture in Cuba, you played at Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, and countless spots all over the world. Tell me what is one of your more interesting stories on the road? I know, say for radio, you accumulate a nice cachet of stories and adventures. Do you have a good one from the road that really kind of sticks in your mind?
Well, you know, the thing I love about the road is I love meeting different types of people. And there are also really fascinating experiences that you have when you're traveling that really are very unlikely to be replicated. So I can tell you as a musician, some of the things that have happened on stage that I really love. I remember years ago touring with Wynton Marsalis, and I was very young. I was still in college at the time, and we were playing Chicago Symphony Hall. It's one of the most beautiful halls in all the world. And we were playing blues in A-flat. I remember the key and everything. And I tell you, I went up some sort of run, and I hit the most wrong note possible. And in that hall, it just was amplified tenfold. So you could tell it just rang out, and the audience felt it too. And everyone sort of went back in their seats. And all of a sudden, Wynton yelled, "Hit it again, hit it again." You know, so I started to hit the note again, and then it just became this unbelievable, intriguing story, like figuring out how I was going to play with that note to make it something interesting. And that's one of the first times that I really learned in public that there are no mistakes on the bandstand.
Yeah.
The only mistake is if you don't have the creativity to turn it into something of beauty.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's true improv right there is what that is.
That's right. You never know.
Yeah, exactly. So let me ask you this, since you've kind of delved into that a little bit. What exactly do you try to say with your music? I know that there's kind of, it's your voice, but is there something that you're saying specifically with your music?
Well, when I think about what I would like to share with the world in terms of my personal values, I think what's most fundamental to what we do is the value of empathy. That first and foremost, we begin with the principle of the unknown. And when you don't know, you end up you end up putting your knowledge in its proper place.
Yeah.
And what you end up doing is you end up listening first if you don't know what's going to happen so that you can figure out what's happening in your environment. You're not prejudiced towards ideas when you're dealing with truly spontaneous improvised music. And I hope to share with people that type of connectivity and the beautiful benefits of leading with empathy before we form opinions about others. So we get on stage and it's this struggle and this sense of love and compassion where we come together as a unit to figure it out and we trust each other. So these are some of the values that I would like to impart through my music.
So speaking of all those musicians that you played with and learned with, you've been with Joe Henderson, with Marsalis, as you mentioned, Milt Jackson, Dr. Billy Taylor. The list goes on and on and on. What is it like to climb on stage with those kinds of legends and luminaries, with the amount of experience and just them being forces? How does it feel to get up next to people like that and play?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, it's truly an honor. I mean, I'm sure people say that all the time, but for me, I feel the gravity of the moment when I step on the bandstand with someone who is of that caliber. I understand very clearly that these are people who are responsible for the creation of this music that I've developed, that I've dedicated my life to. So I take it very seriously, and I try to accept that I belong there. That's the biggest challenge, right? You don't want to judge yourself, especially when you're improvising. You have to learn to control your ego and just to let go. So the first thing for me is really just accepting that I've been asked to be in a situation that there is love, and it's my turn. It's my responsibility to help carry this music forward. Once I can quiet the mind with that sort of philosophy, it's just a matter of letting go and just enjoying the moment. Because these practitioners that you mentioned, these are just brilliant human beings. And music just happens to be one way in which they have chosen to express their brilliance. But many of these musicians are equally brilliant off the bandstand as they are on.
And speaking of that brilliance, you've been around such brilliance and such great musicians. I'm not phrasing this question like you may sit around and think about people you'd want to play with, but is there anybody that's kind of semi in your radar where you every once in a while think, man, it'd be great to get on stage and jam with that person?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've never had the chance to play with Ahmad Jamal, and I think he is just so beautifully soulful, and he embodies the real essence of what this particular type of music is about in terms of connectivity with musicians, connectivity with the audience, creativity, but always on a bed of rhythm and soul, not leading with creativity in the abstract. Right? It's ultimately about authenticity. And whenever I've seen Ahmad Jamal play, I'm just always blown away by his imagination and his feeling and his fearlessness to be an individual. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. So along with all the music you've played, you've gotten a lot of honors. You've had 4 Grammy nominations and many other awards. Is there one that I wouldn't not that, that it's your favorite, but is there an award that you got that really kind of hit you in a certain way and you're like, man, that was cool? Just something that maybe it was where you were at when it happened or a particular setting. Is there something, award that really kind of means something special to you?
Oh, that's a tough question because I wouldn't want to devalue any of the honors that I've been fortunate enough to be blessed with, you know? So they all mean a great deal, given a certain period in my life, what's going on in that moment. But really, I think one of the greatest rewards that I'm receiving in my development is the reward of watching a student grow. I absolutely love teaching. It's truly my life passion as much as performing, certainly 50-50. And to come to the end of the semester and the emails that I might get from some students thanking me for the process that we've gone through over the years and seeing their growth and development, those emails really make me emotional.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to ask you about the distance learning lab. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, so as a vibraphonist, one of the challenges is the idea that I don't travel with my instrument. So I spent 15 years or so traveling almost 6 months out of the year, which meant that I didn't have a lot of time to physically practice my instrument. Of course, I would do exercises to keep my hands in shape, or perhaps I could do some ear training and things of that nature. But for the most part, I couldn't practice. And then I reached a point where I felt that touring alone wasn't going to help me achieve my goal. I'm confident that I should get on stage and play, but I have very, very high standards for myself, and I'm an extremely ambitious person. And in order to grow, I needed to come up with a plan so that I didn't have to travel as much. And part of that is why I'm teaching, although teaching is, like I said, a real passion. And in order to teach in a way that's going to affect things on a national and international level, you need to be out there. So I came up with the idea of setting up a distance learning studio in my home and connecting with other universities so that I can still stay connected as an educator and as a musician, but I can do it from my home. So I can sit and practice 6 hours and then teach in Australia, which I have a university that I work with there, and then I can go upstairs and hang out with my wife and my kids. It's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, that's cool, man. It's very cool. Is there a core tenet that you kind of adhere to when you teach your kids, something that you really want to give them? At the end of the proverbial day, when students leave your teaching, what do you want them to learn?
Well, I like to tell them that what it is that I'm showing them should be very apparent in the way that I'm leading my own life. That if they watch the way that I teach, if they watch the way that I'm working on my own projects, they should see that there's an extreme passion, there's a lot of vision, and there's a lot of dedication, and I accept that it's my obligation to dream and to come up with a plan to manifest the ambition of my dream. So it's not even so much about you should practice this, this, and this. I hope that my students go through a process in which they learn to take things apart after they've spent an extensive amount of time examining what it is they want to do with their time on the planet. I push very hard about vision because a lot of people are obsessed with wanting what someone else has, which is sort of a losing battle. So I'm always telling them that this is their music, that I could never create the music of their generation. Part of their responsibility as artists is to be a sonic manifestation of their time on the planet, of their peer group. And that's something that I can't do. That's something that Charlie Parker did extremely well, and John Coltrane. And it's our responsibility to take ownership of the music and to be authentic in our expression of our world. So I hope that they walk away with that. And I also hope that they don't feel they need to be musicians. Like, any type of narrow description of who they are, I think, is dangerous. I think it's about figuring out who you are authentically and coming up with a plan to monetize what you would express naturally.
Yeah.
In fact, I've stopped calling myself a musician. Years ago, I wrote a thing. I have these notebooks where I'm writing lots of thoughts and my vision for what I'm working on right now. And one of the things that I wrote in my notebook a few years ago, that I am not a musician. I have a gift which manifests itself well in music.
Yeah.
And that was a life-changing statement for me, because I basically gave myself permission to be more than just a musician with that statement. And it was after that statement that I began to do more public speaking and speaking in corporate environments. And that's after that I stepped up to the table and did the TED Talk. And actually, the project that I'm working on now, and I've been working on for about a year and a half, is an app. So I have an ear training app, which I'm hoping to release. Well, I'm definitely going to release this summer. I'm about 2 months away from the release. So I've spent the past year and a half working on an algorithm to teach software to play very musical and intuitive harmony.
Right on. That's cool, man. That's very cool. So speaking of all the teaching and your love of teaching, you obviously have probably been taught well. Who's taught you the most about music?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You know, it's funny. My private teacher, Richard L. Bagley, when I was a kid, is probably my most influential teacher, because very early on, he always made me play with imagination. He would tell me when there was a piece of music that that would just slow down a little bit, and then it would stop for a moment, and then it would speed back up. He would tell me to picture. I remember this in a lesson. He said, you have to picture Times Square. You know what it looks like? I said, yes. And he's like, okay, so you're walking. Now you have to imagine that everything is slowly starting to slow down, and all of a sudden all the color is disappearing from the buildings. And once everything goes black and white, it just stops for one moment, and then it starts to move again slowly, and the color. I mean, it was just, this guy was just so passionate about teaching, and he absolutely changed my life. So I would have to say Richard L. Bagley. But the other thing I would say is, when I started touring right out of college, I got to tell you, I learned more about music from the audiences than I did from the musicians and the teachers that came before. I started to really recognize, and talking to people, and more importantly, listening to people, when you see the type of passion and commitment that people have for the art form, I'm talking about non-musicians. It's such a vital part of their lives. It really helped me understand that's important to know why art is necessary in society, and to be clear on what it is I'm trying to accomplish. But I learned that from the audience, not from other musicians.
Interesting. Very interesting. So you're a part of the San Francisco Jazz Collective, correct?
Well, I actually left about almost 2 years now. I left that organization.
What was that experience like?
That was an amazing experience. I absolutely loved being a part of that organization and that ensemble. I think it's absolutely a brilliant model for how you can have a resident ensemble create music that respects the past while continuing to look forward to the future. I would like to think that Randall Klein and SF Jazz have created a potential prototype for how other large institutions can really create an ensemble that truly embodies the core characteristics, the core values of this art form.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when you were a kid, did you always think you were getting into music? What was your dream when you were a kid?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was classical music early on, so I always dreamed of being the timpanist of the New York Philharmonic. I wanted to be the first African-American timpanist of the New York Philharmonic. And I did very well with classical music, actually. I had a full scholarship to all the schools that I applied. I ended up starting at Eastman and transferring to Manhattan School of Music, and I felt like I was definitely on track. I had won some concerto competitions and toured a little bit. In fact, in high school, I played in some professional orchestras. So things were going really well.
Until
I heard Charlie Parker. I'm not the first person that he's created problems for.
I am amazed at how often, because we're from the home of Charlie Parker, how often he is noted as being the one that's either railroaded or fueled so many dreams in the jazz world. It's amazing. So was there a specific album? I know Charlie Parker moved you when you were a kid, or when you really got into jazz, but was there a specific album that just blew your mind that you were like, man, that's just amazing?
Well, I can tell you, I can very clearly remember the first straight-ahead jazz album that I listened to was in college. It was Charlie Parker's Now's the Time. And there was a really great pianist there at school from Israel. His name's Tamir Hendelman. He actually plays with John Clayton now. He was a grad student when I came in as a freshman, and he sat me down at the piano and started to explain to me what was going on as I was listening to it. And I was thinking, are you kidding me? He's making this up, and he's keeping track of the chord progressions. He's reacting to what Max Roach is doing on the drums. I was so blown away with not only the technical aspect, but the spiritual liberation, the audacity that was present in his playing. I just knew that I felt like I had something to say, and the route that I was going in classical music, I felt was beginning to restrict me a little bit. I enjoyed it. There's something that's very humbling about being in a symphony orchestra. I mean, especially as a timpanist, you strike one note and the trombones blast with you. It feels like you're playing all 60 people. It's an amazing emotional feeling. But I felt like the way I grew up, the neighborhood that I was from, my family and you know, what was in my heart, I couldn't exactly express it unapologetically in that culture. So it was perfect. The timing was right because I felt I learned a lot from having begun my studies in classical music. I also really liked that I didn't start in jazz because I never became part of any one philosophy. Mm-hmm. So when I came to jazz, I came to jazz with the audacity and the attitude that, well, it's about expressing myself, right? I don't have to copy people, and I can learn from others. Obviously, it behooves us all to do that. But my goal was never to just be the greatest bebop player. I always immediately thought I should write a song about what happened yesterday.
Sure.
And do it in my own way, which I think is indicative of the true essence of what traditional jazz is. There's a misnomer. People say traditional jazz and they think of old music or playing stuff from the past. That is absolutely not the tradition of jazz.
That's
very
right.
Antithetical to the tradition of jazz. Jazz has always been a sonic manifestation of a people, of a region, of something happening in the world right now, which is why it's going to remain a pertinent music, and I'm very confident about that. As long as we continue to not let the values inherent in our music be overshadowed by creativity. Creativity is overrated in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of the vibes specifically, what musicians, what jazz cats on the vibes really got you going? Was like, man, that guy is smoking.
Well, I remember when Lionel Hampton passed away, I wrote an article in Downbeat talking about the first time I saw the vibraphone. And I was a little kid, and I didn't start playing at this time, but I remember seeing this thing on television. It was so exciting, and this guy was playing it, and he had so much energy and feeling. And, I realized years later that it was Lionel Hampton that I was seeing. So Lionel Hampton, just as the grandfather of the vibraphone, if you will, just was unbelievable in terms of transcending the instrument and pushing the feel and soul through it. But then when I heard Milt Jackson my freshman year of college, that was a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Milt Jackson's, his tone was so much closer to the human voice. It didn't sound like a percussion instrument at all. And the blues and the authenticity of his playing I found very moving. And then another one of my big heroes would be Bobby Hutcherson, who for me is one of the most imaginative musicians on any instrument. I love to just listen to him play the melody. He doesn't even have to improvise. The thing I love is that when you see him play, you can tell that the music is really unfolding for him. That it's not predictable for him. And we just learn to let go and trust Bobby and trust the music. And what a gift to all of us Bobby Hutcherson is.
Amen. Yeah. So since we're getting bespeckled by the notions of such brilliant jazz musicians, if you end one of your gigs here in the next week and there's a Jazz DeLorean from Back to the Future just sitting there on the curb and the door's up and you can punch in any coordinate, see any show in history, where would you want to go and what would you want to see?
Wow, that's a heavy question. Wow. Let me think about it for a second. I mean, I think listening to Miles Davis, you know, there's a video of him making, is it, he's making Sketches of Spain, I think. Is that the video? Is that the record you're making? I'm spacing out on it, but there's some video that I've seen a bunch of times of Miles Davis in the studio. Uh-huh. And the tone and the relaxation and just the coolness of that. And just, he seemed to truly embody that era. Yeah. I would love to be able to sit in the middle of that level of audacity. I keep coming back to that word because I think to really be a great leader, you have to be audacious. You got to be brave, and you got to be a visionary, and you got to not apologize for the way that you see the world. And again, people like Miles Davis and Muhammad Ali, I think of these people as great, not because of their craft. It's because of what they represented. They inspired ambition in others. They inspired other people to dream big and to not give up. And I just have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me, what is the greatest thing about waking up every day for you?
Wow. Well, I got to tell you, it's being with my family.
Cool.
I absolutely love it. Being home more. I mean, I'm still touring. I'm getting ready to do a record and tour a lot more next year. But this period that I've decided to slow down because I have two young kids has been unbelievably gratifying for me and has made me much stronger as a man. And it's given me much more to express as a musician. And like I said, I'm in a space now where I have something that I need to get out.
Yeah.
So I think that, and then also, you know, once I get up, I get my kids off to school, I come downstairs and I sit at this piano 8 hours straight working on designing this app. And the idea that a year and a half ago, I came up with 10 ideas, and I said, I want to do the one that's most amazing, the one that no one says is possible. And I had no idea how to do it. And I started working on it, just dreaming, and I've made tons and tons of mistakes, and it's been a very, very difficult struggle. But to come down here and to be driven with a fire that is rare for even myself, I'm more alive and more driven today than I ever have been. It's
very
an
cool.
Unbelievable pleasure, and I wish everyone that level of passion and commitment.
Right on. Speaking of commitment and passion, what is it about jazz that you love so much?
Well, I think, again, it's the idea of empathy. It's the idea that you come together, and first and foremost, this is an art form that teaches you to focus on the things that you have in common, and it makes it very clear to you just how insignificant many of the differences are. So I love to step on the bandstand with people who I've never played with for the first time, because my emotional radar is so laser focused on understanding the individuals around me. So I think I think playing jazz in particular and being an improviser has just made me a better human being, because I know the first thing I need to do is to listen and to pay attention to others before I prejudge a situation.
Yeah. Let's say we get together in about 10 years and we catch up and I'm like, what's been going on? What are you going to want to tell me that you're happy happened in the last decade?
I want to revolutionize jazz education.
Cool.
I want to create a methodology, which I've been working on for about 8 years. I'm implementing it now, that really teaches people from a more intuitive perspective, the way that I remember learning about music growing up in the church and the way a lot of great jazz musicians learned about music. I think that jazz education is, the pedagogy is very, very young, and it's a good time for my passion. It's in alignment with the cultural movement of higher education right now. So I would love to do that. I would love to have a series of apps that are very, very vital to helping young and older musicians experience music And as a performing artist, I think it's just, I feel really good as a performing artist. I hope to just continue to document where I am. I'm very careful not to judge myself. So when I make a record, I fully accept that there are a billion events that brought me to the moment that I was in the studio, and there's nothing I can do about it other than enjoy the moment. And I hope that I can continue to do that over the next decade and continue to grow.
Right on. So in the volumes of music and the joy that you've brought to the world, there's so much out there from Stefan Harris. What I want to know right now is, if someone listens to your music at a show and they want to go home and Google you, and they want to find out who you are, from you, in the length of a tweet, tell me who you are, define who you are, kind of define your essence. You got 144 characters. You can weeble wobble one way or another, but I want you to tell me in the length of brevity and the beauty of conciseness, who are you?
I'm someone who is dedicated to spreading the value of empathy. Whether that happens through performing on stage as a musician, or whether it happens in the classroom or in a corporate setting, giving a talk about art and empathy. That's what I lead with, and I hope that when my time is up, that I've affected change in the world in a positive way, by example.
I think you're doing that, man. Hey, that was my final question. Stefan, beautiful man. Hey, the pleasure's been all mine to talk to you today. I appreciate you taking time out for me.
All right, my friend. Thanks for the support.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Stefan Harris for his time, energy, and passion, and being such a force in the jazz world. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.